Welcome to the Super Gamer Podcast. Welcome to the new Super Gamer Podcast, episode 184. Our guest this week is a writer of games and a writer about games. Critic, journalist, writer for Mythwrecked. We have Melindy Hetfeld. Thank you for being here. So let's start with, you're going to be speaking at Games Ground Berlin 2024. Can you tell us what's going to be happening there?
Actually, I have.
Oh, you have? Pardon me.
I have, yes. I have spoken at Games Ground. That was this year.
Well,
it would be nice if they invite me back for next year.
Okay.
I have already done that.
Well, can you tell us what that was like?
Well, it was quite unexpected, because apparently this is a new gaming festival of sorts that they now have in Berlin in Germany. And it is sort of modeled after, I think, a more serious sort of approach to, you know, what we have as sort of a GDC equivalent, I think. And we haven't really had that. We have DEFCON for Gamescom in Germany, but that is kind of prohibitively expensive for a lot of game devs. So I think the idea behind that was to, you know, just get a few panels together, have a space where devs could meet and talk to each other in Berlin. And I was invited as part of a research project, I think it was, which was actually started by the German government, I believe. It was the Ministry for Migration, which gave money for a project looking into what games could do for migrants and to tell migrant stories, and how games would be, you know, particularly well suited for telling those specific stories, and how we could, you know, encourage more developers to kind of tell those stories. And so they got a panel together and just asked me to be the panel moderator. That was basically it. So I wasn't actually all that involved in the actual speaking. I was more like directing people.
I guess not really a panel, but I've done moderation at a similar kind of event. And I find sometimes people are like, I don't really need a moderator. Like, I know what I'm going to be talking about. Like, what was that sort of dynamic like? Were you kind of leading the conversation, or were the panelists like, we got this?
I think it was a bit of both, actually. Like, I had never actually moderated a panel before, but thankfully I know quite a lot of people who've moderated panels, and of course I've like watched a lot of panels, and I get quite nervous ahead of these sorts of things. So I just ask people, like, what am I actually there for? And, you know, you're supposed to moderate. So basically the only job that you have is to make sure that, you know, if you have someone who's very confident and says, like, oh, no, I know what I'm doing, I know what I'm going to be talking about, that, you know, they don't take over the entire conversation. What we did was, basically, I met up with everyone ahead of time and just talked to them about the subject a bit and what they thought, and then I could sort of like set it up in advance to ask certain questions and then, you know, direct them to people, because I remembered, oh, you know, this person had something interesting to say at that point, or this person doesn't know that much about this particular part of the subject, so, you know, we'll make sure that they get to have elsewhere that they can talk a bit more, so just that everyone can basically take their turn. I think that's all you really have to do. And I think I was really lucky, because this group of people, we got on very well immediately. So in the end, even though I'd done all this preparation, I think it's quite useful. It was, you know, more like a chat, actually, where people ended up agreeing a lot with each other, and then just, you know, as soon as everyone's comfortable, that you have those little moments where someone goes, oh yeah, and you know, I want to say more about that, and now that you've said that, and then the time actually passed quite fast. So
what you said, it was kind of a new Games Ground Berlin, that is kind of a new thing. You know, what was your takeaway from it? Do you think it's going to keep going? Did you think it was successful?
I haven't been there for too long because I was honestly just there for my panel, but from what I've seen, it's that kind of thing that I wish gets a bit more attention in the years to come. I mean, this is not necessarily up to me, but I, you know, I'm interested in how they market it and how they get the word out there, because when I was there, I actually met a few people that I know that I didn't know would be there, which is quite nice. And they have quite a lot of developers in Berlin, obviously, because it's the capital. But it would be nice if they had, you know, a bit more reach to, you know, places beyond Berlin, and yeah, to grow this a bit more. So I really hope this is going to be something, because the panels were quite interesting. And I mean, you always have a mix of panels that are maybe for you and then a bit less interesting for you personally. But I think that was a good mix. So I'm definitely interested in seeing what they do with it in the future.
What about, I know you've written before how it can kind of be difficult to find your space when you're both a games writer and a critic. Did you find that at all? Like, were you walking around sort of like, oh, who are my people here, and are they going to accept me, or was it all good?
Weird right now, in particular, because right at this moment, I'm sort of like neither. I don't get a lot of work in either field, so I don't really know what I am at this point. But I had this a bit earlier, and during the year, and while I was still working on Mythrect, that I was like, okay, what am I selling myself as? Because I am a freelancer, which always means that, you know, you're constantly selling yourself to people, even if you don't want to. But you have to make sure that if you network and you meet new people, that they kind of know what you're about. And I think front facing, I'm still mostly a journalist. So if someone looks me up or looks my work up, they're obviously going to see that stuff first, because that's, you know, the biggest part of what I'm doing and what I've been doing. And I've not been that great at, you know, redirecting people and saying like, oh no, actually that's not what I want to be doing in future, and yeah, thanks for reading my stuff, but also don't read that stuff anymore, because now we're going to do something different. So yeah, I'm not so sure what I'm doing or what I should be doing to change that, because it's really sort of a branding exercise, I fear.
Yeah. What about in your piece, New Fandom Who Dis, you say becoming a freelance games journalist kind of killed the romance with games. Like, you know, it's sort of that when your hobby becomes your job kind of thing. And yet you were still able to be a writer of a game. Like, was that something... Is that different than playing a game and feeling like, oh, this is my job? Like, is that a new experience for you? So you were like, wow, this is so cool.
I mean, it depends on what you're doing, because I feel like this feeling of, you know, making your hobby your job and then falling like slightly out of love with it, that's not uncommon. You know, that a lot of people have that, or, you know, you learn certain things about the industry or how the pudding is made, basically, and then you think, oh, actually I don't like that, I wish I didn't know that. Or in some cases you appreciate stuff more because you know how it works. But I think that's also basically the job of a journalist, you know, that we're supposed to empathize with the process. And, you know, as a critic, I always want to take that into account. So I think at first, actually learning more about how games are made as a writer on a game helped me to then, you know, look at games in a critical context and be like, oh, you know, I don't like certain aspects of this game, but I can tell how they came about, and then probably be more mellow about it. But I also just always had this feeling of a bit of envy, I think, when I was still mainly a journalist. That, I mean, I really love journalism because it's basically just talking to people. But, you know, when someone tells me about making something, I always used to think, oh, I wish I could do that too, and I would like to make something like that and not just talk about someone else's thing, you know? And I think that's what, in the end, made me want to switch to game design, because you look at something and, I mean, everyone's like, oh, I could probably, you know, do better than this, or this is just not very good. But at some point, you kind of think about proving that. So I think that's what it was for me.
And how did you find the experience? Was it harder, easier than you thought, you know, more fulfilling, or how was it?
I thought it was extremely fulfilling, definitely. And even though it's work and it's hard work, I really, really loved it, and I was really happy to do it. And it was really sort of an arrival for me, because I think if we play games the way that most developers intend us to, we don't really think about a lot of the stuff that goes on behind the curtain. But I just thought every single thing was sort of magical. I mean, also sometimes magical in a really annoying sort of way, where you're like, oh, you can't do it like this, and it's not, this is actually a really annoying sort of process, and it takes a long time. But then when it comes together, it's just, you know, it's my words on the screen, and they move, and the character says them. I think that's the greatest thing ever, and I really just loved it. But it is hard work to get there, and in some cases it was more difficult than I thought, because I mean, every writer tells you that you have to be able to write even when you don't feel like writing. But sometimes you just sit there and you're on a deadline and you just have to have an idea, and the idea is just not there, or you know, you just don't like what you're producing, and you just, there's a lot of putting stuff off to try again at a different point in time. So you're basically doing 20 different things at a time, because obviously nothing's just a sequence of things that you have to do or events that you have to finish. So yeah, it's a bit frustrating to have basically all these different building blocks and none of them are finished.
Speaking of 20 things at a time, answering Laurent Victorino on Blue Sky, you were talking about reviewing games and how one thing you'd love is reliable code releases and enough time to actually play the game before embargo ends, and that, you know, you're often juggling more than one game at a time to review. Is it hard? I mean, obviously that sounds really hard to me. Is it hard when you're doing like more than one game at a time and you're trying to get to the end? Do you even know like which game made you feel what sometimes, or are you like conflating which one you're thinking of?
This was actually interesting, because when Laurent asked that, it was just the busiest period of the year, and I was honestly playing 3 games at a time. And I mean, in some ways I don't mind that, because if you play a game and it's a really long game and it goes on for quite a while and maybe it's not that good, it's kind of nice to have something else to switch to. But also, it's just, I mean, when I get to that point where I think, oh, you know, can this be over? That's always a bad sign. But that's more about the game than how many games I'm playing at the time, because I don't know how many people really just play one game until they're done and then they put it down. I feel like this would be an extremely difficult thing to do for most people who kind of really want to keep up with, you know, most popular releases, because there's so many games. So I feel like, I mean, there must be a lot of people who are like, oh, you know, I'll dip a toe in here and then another in there and then just see what it's like. But I think when you just do that and you don't do it for work, you know, it doesn't have to, you don't have to make it stick. You don't have to, like, think about these things very hard. And for me, if it gets too many games, then obviously I just don't feel like playing any of them anymore. And yeah, that is a bit of a challenge, but that could also just be me, because I know a lot of people who obviously they write and then they also, you know, they finish work and then they stream. And so I just always thought, oh, maybe I just don't like games that much. Is that it? Or is it too many games? I'm not sure.
Do you think, like, especially considering burnout, do you think that a reviewer needs to actually fully beat a game in order to review it? Or is there like, all right, I've played 20 minutes, an hour, 2 hours, whatever. Is there an amount where you're like, I get the game, I can review this?
I mean, this is sort of an unpopular thing to say, or at least a very popular thing to discuss now and then. But it depends on the game, really. I think there are games where after a certain amount of time, you just know, even if you wouldn't finish them. Because sometimes it happens that I read a review and it, I mean, this is kind of like a popular running gag at this point, where someone says, oh, you just, after 15 hours it really gets going.
Right.
if a game takes you 15 hours to really get going, and something is going on there, right? So if I don't know after like 15 hours, then I probably won't know. Like, I don't know how many people retire games, but I feel like most people who tell you that it's absolutely necessary to finish a game probably don't finish games themselves all that much. Like, it really depends. Like, I would never tell someone to, like, not finish something that's obviously really story-reliant. I don't know, something like Alan Wake 2, where, you know, a lot of the best bits obviously happened towards the end, because it's sort of like a dramatic build-up. And as a developer, I'd obviously, you know, like if people actually finish games because they like finishing them. But some games also get so ridiculously long that I just think, like, oh, I don't need to play like 90 campaigns of the same thing to be able to tell that I like this strategy game. So it really depends.
Right. And where's the line for spoilers in either a critique or a review? Like, at what point does even describing the mechanics of the game, you know, is any of that like, uh-oh, people need to learn this for themselves?
Most of the time there is sort of an editorial line. I get told quite often from publishers where the line is for spoilers. So they will say something like, please don't mention this, or don't talk about anything past this chapter. That happens quite often. With mechanics, it's like the general idea for a lot of publications is like, do you really need to tell people about every little thing, especially when it gets quite intricate? Because it gets just, you know, boring to read otherwise. So you just be like, okay, you know, you probably know this, because a lot of these things aren't new, so you can sort of like have a shortcut by just telling people, like, oh, you know, this is something that you might have seen in similar games, but Yeah, it depends. I'm not too big of a fan of, like, because, you know, we're on word counts as well most of the time. So if I have to, like, waste half of my word count on telling people how a game is played, then they're missing the actual bit that's important most of the time, and which is why.
Why do you never want to solve the definition of indie game?
Because at this point it's so muddled, I think that there is no point to it. I mean, there are, like, even if I say this, I'm probably, like, just opening this up again, but there are genuine indie developers who obviously, you know, get no funding from a publisher, but there are almost no developers like this anymore. So, if, you know, best case, you want to be able to depend on someone, because that's how games are made, in what's hopefully a good environment, which is one that doesn't make you worry about money all the time. So, you know, everyone has some funding. Most people don't use their savings to develop a game for, like, 4 years. So it's useless to talk about, because it's, you know, when people say that, is this an indie game or not, like, they're talking aesthetics or how much money is in that, or is it, you know, influenced by someone else's opinion. And that's just I know that's useless metrics for just one word. You know, if you want to stuff all of that into one word, you never stop discussing it. So let's just not do it.
I do find that often when people say, oh, it's an indie game, sometimes they just mean, like, it looks retro.
Yeah. Yeah, or they just want to say, like, oh, you know, I don't like that, so it must be an indie game. Which obviously hurts me quite a lot. But it's just this weird thing where, I mean, we had all these different times where, like, you know, we had indies with, like, Xbox arcade games, and then the big indie apocalypse, and I feel like a lot of people just nowadays want to say that they're indie, because then that means, you know, that they're in charge or whatever, but yeah, mostly it's just an aesthetic thing for a lot of people. And then I'm just like, you know, if people get to keep their jobs, which, you know, these days isn't really a given, that I don't care too much where the money comes from, you know, within reason. But yeah, money comes from somewhere, usually.
Something I didn't mean to gloss over earlier, and, you know, please tell me if you'd rather not get too into it, but what is the state of the games journalism industry right now? Like, you know, you've said online, and you said on this show that, like, you know, work's hard to come by. Like, where are we right now?
I think it's no secret at this point that it's quite bad. I mean, obviously, it's different for me as a freelancer, because freelancers, we just always lose and we gain. The only difference that I can tell after having done this for a while is just that, you know, I lose on one end and I don't gain something back on the other. So you always have website closures. You always lose something that was fairly regular. That stuff can always happen to you at any point in time, and that's normal, and that's something that you sort of have to deal with. But you used to have something that you could fall back on, and the amount of outlets that we have and the budgets that those outlets have, everything just gets more truncated and just gets smaller and smaller, and you just don't know where to go anymore. And I mean, this is true if you wanted to find a staff job in games media right now as well, because, you know, just the pool of staffers gets smaller as money gets saved there, and it's just not a sustainable space. And ironically, I don't think it was a sustainable space when I started, because that was one of the first things that I was told when I started, that, you know, you just have a regular sort of overturn where someone is like, oh, I don't want to do this anymore. And then, you know, someone else steps in and freelances there, and then someone else will, you know, go to a staff job, and then someone will just come after them. But you don't have that anymore, because I know quite a lot of people right now who don't know where to go. So they do want to do something else, or they need to do something else, because it's just, you know, financially not viable, and they don't know what to do.
Do you see any sort of, like, is there a way to right the ship, or what needs to happen?
I mean, if I knew how to solve this, you'd think I'd be better paid. It is also one of those things where, you know, it's all quite numbers oriented, and I think this is happening in games media and just in games in general right now, because there's a lot of people losing their jobs right now, obviously. So, you know, there's a focus on, okay, we spent all this money at some point, we made all of these investments, and then we just needed to grow. Like, the general capitalist growth mindset that you have, that you buy something and it immediately needs to grow and you need to profit off of it. But I would, even though that's, you know, obviously not how it's going to work, just, I'd like more empathy, because everyone is working really hard all the time, and the quality of this stuff, we've got such high quality in all these sectors in the gaming industry, because everyone really loves what they do, and they wouldn't do it otherwise, because a lot of people definitely don't do it for the money. But I'd just be like, you know, if you invest in things, just remember that you're also investing in people. You know, these are people with livelihoods, and you can't expect good work from them if they're always going to be scared of whether they're going to have a job tomorrow. And that's obviously where, you know, burnout for a lot of people comes from. So I just love for people to be safer, but yeah, that just doesn't work if, you know, you don't have a sustainable business model.
Right. Well, talking a bit about some of your work in the past, there's a line in your article, "Few games obsess me like SSX Tricky," from May 22, 2022, Eurogamer. It's a line that sticks out to me because I totally agree. There's always something about throwing yourself from a big height in video games. And yeah, I don't know. Jumping in games is my thing. Like, there's something so satisfying about being able to do a big jump.
Right? I feel like the entire Assassin's Creed series, or like 80% of Assassin's Creed, is just like people going up a very high building and then throwing themselves off. And yeah, sometimes also assassination happens. But that's what you really want to do, isn't it? But it's also like with SSX, the jumping feels really good, but you also get a lot of, like, positive reinforcement. Like, you jump and someone always goes woohoo, and then the DJ goes like, hell yeah, and you know, there's a lot of noise and a lot of positive reinforcement going on that I really like, which obviously you don't have, like, in a lot of games if you're just jumping. Or maybe you could tell me, I actually don't know if, you know, there's a lot of, like, I'm thinking of, like, Mario.
Yeah, that's sticking out of my head, too, and I guess there's the satisfying, you know, boing, but...
Yeah, something like that, or him just going, woohoo!
Right.
Every time he jumps. Or there's a Polygon video about the hat throw, and why that is so nice. And sometimes it's also just, like, a really nice jumping animation. Jumping is great, man.
I wish I could do it well in real life.
Yeah, but that's one of those things, you know, I have all this content available to me now where someone's just telling me in detail why a jump is great or how much work goes into a jump. And as someone who loves games, like, why would I not want to know this, or why would I not want to, like, acknowledge this? And I feel like what we focus on now is stuff like, no, this is not a ray traced puddle and shit like this, where I'm sorry, I said
no, no, go ahead.
But then again, I'm like, yeah, but you can have ray traced puddles if you want. Like, you can see your character in a mirror now in some games. Like, why would you even do that? Like, when I was a very young gamer, we didn't have mirrors, or, you know, we could be happy if we could tell that something was a mirror. And now you have all these things, and I just really like learning about that kind of stuff, you know, if it's a jump or I don't know what else. There's just so many little things that someone put in oodles of time just to make that really satisfying. And those small things were really things that I love to write about.
You also pointed out to me, I didn't know Mixmaster Mike produced the music in SSX Tricky, and I love the Beastie Boys, so very cool.
Yeah, it was a big thing at the time, because when you play the original game, they had all that sort of like behind the scenes stuff in the extras section.
Right, right.
Because, you know, it was PS2 game, so it was, you know, more space. And there's a lot of games that I have from that time that are like, oh, it's like a DVD, so we have to, like, put DVD extras in our games. And that was in there. You can see those on YouTube. They're quite good. I really encourage you to watch those.
Cool. You in an older article, an opinion article from PlayStation Magazine UK, August 2018, you talk about how games need to give, or they should be giving, a reason for friendship instead of just taking for granted, you know, like, okay, you're with this person now and you like them. And it made me think Diablo 4, I'm playing a lot lately, and I don't know why, honestly. It's not that good, personally. But I've put a lot of time into it, which is weird. But that game definitely, maybe friendship's the wrong word, but what irritates me so much in it is it puts you in this world, and it suggests your character, like, doesn't know the people here, doesn't know the religion here, and then suddenly it's like you're fully in it, you're following that religion, you're doing all this stuff. I'm like, why? Why would I not be skeptical about what's going on?
I mean, this is also, I think this is a particular fantasy game sort of thing, because the first game that I always think of when I is like Dragon Age, where you can basically, I mean, Dragon Age at least lets you choose a little bit of whether you want to, like, do that religious stuff or whether you want to be, I know, also now that I'm saying this, is like, you can choose to be religious or evil, which is, but with friendships, it's that kind of thing where now, this was quite a while ago, now when I'm looking at it, it's a really simple sort of idea that requires quite a lot of work on the game design front, because you want to make friends somehow, and you want to make that sort of, like, that progress that you're making visible. So there's, like, a lot of things, and I don't like any of them. So you have, like, progress bars or hearts and stuff, and none of that is, I mean, obviously, really what you do in real life. And I mean, a lot of people don't want that, but I would really like a game, and this would probably be very frustrating to play, but visual novels sometimes do this quite well, where you don't really know what's going on. You don't know if this person likes you or not. And sometimes that's what making new friends is like, right? You don't know. But what you have in a lot of games is, you know, you funnel gifts in one end and then you get friendship out of the other. And that's, I mean, if it worked like that, great. But we can't like tell people on one hand, in, you know, like real life friendship making, you can't buy friends, and then have them actively buy friends. And I mean, there's a lot of things that you do in games that you probably wouldn't do. But this is one of those things where I'd really like to at least see an attempt at a better solution. And in Mithrecht, we spent quite a lot of time just on the language surrounding friendship and what you do if you want someone to be your friend. So, you know, obviously, first of you have to establish that you want to be someone's friend and not make them your friend, because you can't make people anything. And then also, like, what are you willing to do for them to make that happen? And sometimes it's really just single words that make the difference. And I don't think that even a lot of people will notice that. But I think it's, for me, it was very important to make sure that it's not another exchange. Because what you're really doing in games is not, you're not building friendship. You're sort of like bartering or like networking at most, where you're doing this because you're getting something out of it, even if it's just, I don't know, the PlayStation trophy. And that's just not how it works. And I just want to try. It could be really frustrating in the end, but, you know, I'd at least like to try.
We'll end on Mithrecht right away. Just a couple quick questions, and then, sorry, I actually have to go to work soon. But you're very into cycling. What's the best cycling game that you've played?
There is none. it is my with great sadness, I have to say that not even the official, and I'm sure no one, this will not get back to me, but not even the official Tour de France game, which is sort of like a Football Manager-esque game, is good. I mean, it's also like no one is interested in that. You know, it's not, cycling is not football. I'm not waiting for this to be a thing at any point. I am right now writing a visual novel where I'm trying to teach people about cycling, because I think it's the greatest sport ever invented. But it's not necessarily one for games, I think. So no, there is none.
Fair enough. Do you still play The Curse of Monkey Island at least once a year?
Yes. Yes.
When was your last playthrough?
I haven't done this year's playthrough, because I usually do it around either my birthday or around Christmas, because that's literally like my Christmas or my birthday treat. It's a bit easier now because I now obviously can just play it on Steam, whereas before I had to like install it and then scum it so it would actually run and like, you know. But I still play it. It's just, I'm a bit sad now that I'm just too fast. Like I wish I wouldn't. Maybe I should actually take a break, like an Assassin's Creed fatigue, sort of Monkey Island fatigue break, because I just, if you know everything and you can, you know, basically follow the entire game by heart, it's just, I get faster every year. It's not the same.
I have to ask, why Monkey Island 3 over 1 and 2?
Monkey Island 3 was, I think it was just, I mean, it wasn't even my first. My first was Monkey Island 2. But, I think it's purely nostalgia, honestly, because, you know, I just wanted to say I think it's the best, but obviously no one else thinks that, and that is fine. But it's just one of those things where several of the things that we now take for granted in games sort of like come together. So it had those 2D graphics and they were really smooth, and the voice acting is just really good, and it was a fully voice acted game. You know, that was kind of, those were the two big things, and then I don't know, everything about this was sort of like really miraculous to me. And it was also the game that I learned to speak English with. So yeah, it's all just rose-colored glasses type stuff, really.
Cool. Well, as far as Mythwrecked, people can check out Mythwrecked, keep up to date on it at mythwrecked.com. Sell us on it. Why should people check out this game?
I think you should check out this game if you want to do me a personal favor, because I worked really hard on it. But also because it is trying to be more than a cozy game. It looks really good and it looks really cozy, and it is really cozy. But it's not just a cozy game. It's a game about friendship. It's a game about quite difficult decision making. Sometimes people talk about mental health and the struggles that they face. So I think a lot of people playing this will sort of identify with it, and it's just going to be a nice island getaway, but also, you know, it will have quite a lot of depth to it.
Cool. And people can check you out at Malindy. That's MALINDY.card, CARRD.co. Malindy Hetfeld, thank you for being here.
Thank you again for having me. It was really nice.